Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm going to talk about some work I did with Francesco, who's not in the room. So he knows everything. So I'm going to talk about some work that I've been doing with him. So it consists of two papers we wrote together while we were in CERN last year. And then I'm going to tell you about the latest things that we're doing to try and develop an asymptotically safe standard model. So it's going to be, a lot of it's going to follow on from what you heard this morning, which is good. So I can kind of skip over some things, hopefully. And the idea is what we'd like to do is to really begin, it's a kind of bottom-up approach, I suppose, that we're trying to begin with the standard model, which we know should be what falls out of any asymptotically safe setup. And then we're trying to build up towards something which can give you the asymptotic safety you want. And so the takeaway cartoon, if you like, from this talk is going to be the fact that the overall picture that you end up with is you have some sort of UV completion here, which is your asymptotically safe theory. And so the width of this is roughly giving you an idea of the number of states in the theory. And so what happens is you have this gigantic mess here, and what's supposed to drop out at the bottom is the standard model. And so you have to begin with something. Well, you have to add a lot of degrees of freedom to make the thing well behaved in the UV, which is a kind of interesting unifying theme with string theory, actually. So in order to make itself nicely behaved in the UV, you have to add a lot of degrees of freedom. So it's a kind of recurring theme which I'm noticing. Anyway, so the way I've done it, I mean, this is roughly the outline, which I'm going to try and follow. There's quite a lot of stuff to get through, but a lot of it's been covered. So I hope I'm not going to be flicking over too much stuff. So I'm going to begin with motivating the idea. I mean, you really all know this in this audience, but anyway, I'm just going to skip over that a little bit. I mean, I have some comments which are really coming from my other perspective as someone who's a refugee from string phenomenology. So there are sort of new perspectives that I can give you on that. And then I'm going to talk, I'm going to just cover that a little bit. So you heard these theories talked about before today, so I'm going to just cover them very briefly. And then I'm going to talk about the first thing that we noticed about this sort of theory is you can insert in there a mechanism for radiative symmetry breaking, which looks a little bit like what happens in the MSSM in supersymmetry. So once you've got a theory which has got relevant operators, so mass terms in it, which are technically natural, there's nothing to prevent you doing the same thing that you do in supersymmetry. So in supersymmetry, famously, you generate electroweak symmetry breaking radiatively. And the same thing happens in these theories. And then I'm going to show you how you can attempt to construct an asymptotically safe standard model. And so some of the issues which come out of that. So the first part, I mean, this is really two parts. The first part is going to be what was in the paper. And then the second part is really how we're developing it now. And it does look as if you can pretty much embed the standard model as it is into one of these theories very naturally, but it can just drop out. Right, okay, so just to begin with, I'm going to motivate you. I mean, you're all here, so you're motivated already, but you know about the problems. I'm just going to summarize them. So there are two problems which bother us. One is the hierarchy problem, and the other is the triviality problem. So you've heard about both of those things today. It's kind of interesting to compare it with other theories and see what happens in those theories where you don't have that problem. So one of the theories that you know of is QCD. So that doesn't have either of those two problems. And the first problem, there's no hierarchy problem, because in QCD, even if I give quark masses, they're protected by a symmetry, by chiral symmetry. So there's no hierarchy problem in QCD. And there's also no triviality problem because it's supposedly asymptotically free. It's supposed to be asymptotically free. So we can happily have a coupling which is non-zero in the infrared and tends towards zero in the ultraviolet. So there's no triviality problem. There's only one coupling. And it's well behaved in that sense. And so it's interesting to compare with string theory. So string theory does have a hierarchy problem. So in my status as string refugee, the hierarchy problem in string theory comes because, yes.
Heat mass hierarchy problem in this case.
Yes, yeah. So, yeah.
The cosmological constant.
Oh, right. I mean, the cosmological constant is, so in this entire talk, I'm going to relegate that to gravity, and I'm not going to really touch on gravity in this talk, yeah.
But that's for the string theory.
That's for the string theory, yeah. The string theory that you're also screwed even more by the cosmological constant. Yeah. So for any relevant operator. Yeah. So in the string theory, of course, string theory is supersymmetric as you construct a consistent one. And so when the problems arise when you break supersymmetry. So however I construct the string theory, I will try and break supersymmetry by some mechanism. So for example, if you're familiar with the Schirch-Schwarz mechanism, that's one way to break supersymmetry. You compactify and you break supersymmetry at the same time. It can generate masses for you, which are of order the Kaluza-Klein mass. And unfortunately, that is not enough to protect the Higgs. What typically will happen is that the Higgs will pick up the same mass as your compactification scale. There's no way to have a Higgs mass which is much less than that. So, you know, the supersymmetry breaking in the fundamental theory just feeds directly into the Higgs or any scalar that you're interested in. So that's the hierarchy problem which sort of reappears in string theory. There isn't in string theory a triviality problem. So it's a slight issue with your statement that it's Lagrangian theory. String theory isn't really a Lagrangian theory, I would say, because you go to the ultraviolet and all hell breaks loose there. So for example, there are non-perturbative things start to happen and there are dualities there and so on, which make the whole thing well-behaved in the ultraviolet. So there's no triviality problem in a string theory, even if I just think of it perturbatively, it's well-behaved. But yeah, the hierarchy problem is really sort of the killer issue. So with QCD, there's a kind of philosophy in QCD, which we're going to try and just transfer to the standard model, which is that if we have a mass, if we have a running mass, which is well behaved, so these masses will be running, but it's technically natural, then there's no problem with it. We can set a relevant operator to be whatever we want. And it doesn't mean that the theory is inconsistent. Sorry, infinities, it just means that it's a sign that the thing is running in the field theory. It's not necessarily a sign that there's a hierarchy problem if the particular operator is technically natural. So those things we simply measure and let them run. And so they're effectively zero in the UV because they're relevant. So they're irrelevant to the UV, in other words. All right, so those are hints we'd like to take to an asymptotically safe theory. And so I'm just going to show you the basic idea of asymptotic safety, which you all know very well, hopefully, which is that what you'd like to do is you have some kind of RG scale, and the couplings will run from something in the IR, which may be blowing up. You don't particularly mind. It could become non-perturbative, like QCD becomes non-perturbative at some point. But in the ultraviolet, they all become flat, so they go to some value, and they stay there. It doesn't matter how far you take your renormalization time into the ultraviolet, they don't move. And what happens in your theory space and in your coupling space is that your theory is flowing from a critical surface in the ultraviolet, it has to flow to be an asymptotically safe theory. It has to flow precisely from a critical surface. So the critical surface I'm showing here is actually a point. And the reason I'm showing a point is because the gauge-Yukawa theory is are nice in that their critical surface is actually just a point, so it's maximally predictive. That's the nice thing about them. So if you don't quite hit the point, if you deviate from that theory, so that would be a theory with an irrelevant operator, it deviates from your ultraviolet fixed point, it just means that this particular trajectory is not a candidate for an asymptotically safe theory. It doesn't mean that this red theory is fine-tuned or anything. It just means that when the theory originates from the ultraviolet, it has to do so from this particular point. It's the only place it can come from. Right, so that's the basic idea. I'm sure you're all familiar with it, but it's nice to kind of summarize it. And so in order to sort of decompose what's happening in any theory, what you can do is you can take its operators and you can categorize them into different types of operator. So the ones which we don't like are irrelevant operators. So that means that they blow up in the ultraviolet. I'm going to use the notation relevant, irrelevant. I'm always flown to the infrared when I use those terms. Otherwise, I get doubly confused. So irrelevant operators, those operators you set to be precisely zero, otherwise you'll never hit the ultraviolet fixed point. So those things are precisely zero. There are marginal operators. So those things, they can become exactly marginal, or they can float to zero in the ultraviolet, you don't really mind. Relevant operators, so for example, mass terms, they're irrelevant to the ultraviolet. But they can determine an infrared fixed point. So they don't make any difference to the ultraviolet fixed point. So those things, relevant operators, those are things that you really just set by hand, and they're the same thing as the mass terms in QCD. They're just a parameter you set by hand, which will run, but it doesn't change anything in the ultraviolet. And then there are two other ones. So there's dangerously irrelevant operators, and those are things which grow in both the ultraviolet and the infrared direction. So they look as if they're irrelevant, so they're flowing to small values, but then they blow up in the infrared. So where you see that is in supersymmetry. So if in the duality cascade, that's an important thing. So then there's this final thing, which I called harmless relevant operators. So those things are something that shrinks in the ultraviolet and infrared, but in between it's non-zero. And the reason I put it there is one of my questions. So whether those things are actually allowed. I mean, I don't know of any examples. So it's a kind of question to the audience, really.
What's the question again?
Is it possible to have an operator that is zero in the ultraviolet and infrared, but non-zero? That's possible.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. It's zero in ultraviolet, zero in infrared, yeah. Not zero in between.
Yeah.
Well, but is that just a beta function itself?
Isn't it?
In proportion to the beta function. But it's zero in ultraviolet, the fixed point, it's zero in infrared, the fixed point, but it's never zero anywhere else.
It's zero. Is zero in the middle? It's non-zero in the middle. It's an operator that's finite in the middle.
Yeah, yeah, but
flows to zero.
Anything proportional to the beta function is correct. It's exactly the thing that
is something like that.
Because it's zero at the fixed points both sides, but right. Never zero in the between.
So what's the operator that you're thinking of?
F square, for example. Okay. Any operator which is strictly proportional to a beta function.
Yeah,
exactly.
The trace
of
energy,
yeah.
The trace, yeah. So flow between two fixed points.
You add the operator, and it doesn't affect ultraviolet. It's harmless. It doesn't affect the infrared, but it's non-zero in between.
Right. Yeah. That was quick, yeah. Okay. All right, so I have to...
The day with one coffee, it's not...
Yeah, yeah. So I have to think of better questions.
Or the coffee is really good.
Right. Okay, so that's the overall setup. And then just something on ultraviolet versus infrared fixed point. So you've seen this equation before today. And what you do, for example, at the Banks-Zaks fixed point, which is our kind of go-to fixed point is you arrange your flavors and color so that you very nearly cancel the one loop contribution to the beta function. And then you can arrange a weakly coupled fixed point by balancing the two loop against the one loop contribution, as long as this thing, NF over NC, is roughly 11 halves. So that's the Banksack's fixed point. And as it turns out, this is a fixed point flowing to the, well, in the infrared most of the time. So it's very easy to get one of these things in the infrared. The tricky part is to make an ultraviolet fixed point. So this is what you'd like to be doing. And so this is a cartoon of an ultraviolet fixed point. Is that you'd like to just reverse the sign of your beta function so that you've got this curve. And so then it's flowing out of this point. So if it's above the line, it flows to the left. So it has to. So then it's an ultraviolet fixed point. That's what you'd like to do. But it's hard to do that. And so it was thought to be impossible, but is apparently not impossible since 2014. So this is a kind of a very interesting example of a model which has an ultraviolet fixed point. And as far as I know, this is like this is still relatively unique, isn't it? This,
as good as it gets.
It's as good as it gets. Yeah. So you've seen this as well. It's a Geiji-Kawa theory. And you're basically doing the same thing as you do in the Banksack's fixed point. So you're solving this perturbatively for vanishing beta functions, but it just so happens that the beta functions are telling you that it's running from an ultraviolet fixed point. So in terms of the beta functions, these are the actual numbers. And the important thing is this negative contribution coming from the Yukawa coupling in the beta function of the gauge coupling. So it's really a kind of interaction between these two couplings, which is making it work. And so in terms of pictures, so this was the one in the paper. So it was such a strong folklore that I didn't quite believe that this happened. So I did it myself, and this is my picture. I added another dimension to give it, make it look as if I contributed something new, but actually this is exactly the same physics. So this is what happens. So this is three of the four couplings. And so you see that it flows around. So the V coupling doesn't actually flow very much, if you notice that from previously. So that we can kind of ignore this one. And the other three, they flow quite violently, in the other three dimensions towards this critical line here. And so you can then label things. So this is your UV fixed point, which is your critical surface for this theory, just a point. And this is the infrared fixed point, which is a Gaussian one, so everyone flows to zero. You see they flow very rapidly. The arrows are kind of equally spaced renormalization time. So it flows very rapidly to this line, and you see that this is like arrow. This is thick because this is arrows bunched together, so it's flowing very slowly along the critical line. And so it's a very nice kind of laboratory to do physics with then. So for example, because there's only one, the ultraviolet fixed point is just one point, the critical surface. It means that you can solve everything in terms of just one coupling. So you can solve the other couplings in terms of alpha G. And alpha G is then, you can just trade your renormalization time, the T, for your gauge coupling. So then you really just have one parameter, which is telling you where you are along the flow. So it's a really nice
alpha
system to think about. Sorry?
Alpha H is a quartic.
Alpha H is the quartic, yeah. Yeah.
And the fixed point is the line.
So this is the fixed point, the ultraviolet fixed point.
Just a point. Okay.
Yeah, and the line is the critical line.
They converge on the line, and then they go to the.
Yeah. So where you are on the line is given by T, basically. Mm. Everything else is fixed. So this is the idea. I mean, as T goes back to, you know, as T goes to infinity, you really just end up at this point. That's all that happens. You see, if you don't quite hit it, if you're on the wrong line, you'll end up going off somewhere else. You won't hit this thing. So there's only one candidate theory that could be the asymptotically safe
alpha
one.
Alpha V was the mass term.
V is the... Wait a minute, I'm going to have to remind myself.
So it's alpha V, not the two self-coupling.
Two quartics.
Two quartics, yeah.
Single trace is double trace.
Yeah.
That's a little quartic.
Yeah, you need both of them.
So H is a single trace.
It's a dimensionless theory. Dimensionful parameters.
This has no dimensionful parameters yet.
But you can add them, it's only that they don't affect ultraviolet fixed particles.
Yeah.
They don't, in general.
No, because the normal dimension are going to be very tiny since it's pretty efficient.
Yeah, I mean the irrelevant operators they won't change this fixed point because you know if I go to high enough energy.
Dimensional analysis.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So they have a classical dimension, so you can ignore them. Yeah. Right. So I get the feeling that I'm. How much time do I have?
20 minutes down the road.
20 minutes down the road. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead to okay. Kalman-Weinberg doesn't work, in case you're wondering. Not naively. You might think you could do Kalman-Weinberg with that type of thing. So I'm just going to talk about what happens when you add a relevant operator. So we can add to this theory relevant operators. They won't change the ultraviolet fixed point. And you can ask yourself, how do those things flow? So you can, for example, examine this one. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm just going to skip ahead to to this one. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to add mass terms. And in order to do so, I'm going to take the mass squared terms for this Higgs. I'm going to take the Higgs, I'm going to decompose it into flavor components, S-U-N-F, flavor components. So this is the trace part, and these are generators of S-U-N-F. And the reason I have to do that is because what I'm doing, I'm going to be doing a looking at the Kalman-Weinberg potential in order to find the running of a mass squared. And in order to do that in a consistent way, I have to find, decompose my states into flavor components in order to make it sort of tractable. Right, so if I add to the potential these operators, so I've got an M0 squared, which goes like the trace of the Higgses, right? Trace in flavor space. And I add an additional contribution to each of the generator components. I add something which goes like delta squared, which is small. So it's this is small compared to that, I'm thinking. So in other words, every flavor component, every component of the Higgs is almost the same, except these bits, so the TA components, have a slightly larger mass than the trace component. So everyone gets this mass, M0 squared. Only the off-diagonal generators of SUNF get this component, right? So the trace part is zero here. So this is the trace part plus everyone. This is everyone except the trace part. So initially, you start the running like this. So there's a degenerate mass squared for everyone, so M0 squared, and that's the same for both the scalar and the pseudoscalar components. They both get the same M0 squared. And then the off-diagonal generators get this contribution. So it's M0 squared plus a little bit. So that's how we're starting off the running. And this is what happens. So you can imagine, I don't have to show you the details, but you can imagine what happens is you take this generator, plug it into the one loop potential, so the Kalman-Weinberg potential, you extract the contribution at one loop, so the t-dependent bit, you solve the Kalman-Zamanzik equation, you get a flow equation for m squared, you solve that. And then what happens is you get something like this. So your flow of these generators, m0 squared will flow, and it depends on two parameters. So the m0 squared and the delta squared, it's two independent parameters. For each of those parameters, they're relevant operators. They're determined by a gauge invariant. So they just have a trajectory. I have to choose their value. And so you end up with something like that. So this is for me to choose. It's a gauge invariant. This is something depends on the gauge coupling. So this is the fixed point value with the star. This is the gauge couplings it runs. And this is the delta star squared. Again, I can choose this. And this thing, the nu, is roughly one. So this is M0 squared. This is the off-diagonal masses. So this is M0 squared plus delta squared, if you like. They go like this plus something. So the important point is that this M0 squared is getting a negative contribution. And these things, they're just numbers. So the coefficients in the beta function of m squared. So they're just numbers. And what just happened, just so happens that this number is larger than that number. So this bracket dies away quickly, and you're left with that one, and it gives you a radiative symmetry breaking. Even if I begin with only positive values for all of the mass squared, so m0 squared is large and positive, in the end, this thing dies away, and the difference between the flavor non-degeneracy part is the thing that wins, and that gives you a negative contribution. So you end up with this spectrum. So you start off, something looks like that. The degenerate part dies away quickly, and you're left with everybody going to something like that. So it's much smaller, so everyone's shrunk, but you're left with a whole load of positive things, so that's all the off-diagonal things, and one large negative m0 squared. So it can generate some radiative symmetry breaking for you. And this is kind of similar to what happens in the MSSM. The MSSM, something similar happens because of the coupling to the top of the Higgs, if you're familiar with that, electroweak symmetry breaking. And it's the same thing that's happening here. So that was the first thing I was going to show you, and so you can draw a potential for this thing. That's the first thing I was going to show you. The second thing was how to try and construct the standard model inside this thing. And you're going to tell me now I have no time left at all.
Well, you're 27 minutes.
Okay, I'm going to show you how you can try and embed the standard model in this sort of setup. So hopefully, if you just look at the first three lines of this table, you'll hopefully recognize that these states, the first three, are basically the Geijy-Kawa theory. So we're beginning with that theory. And we have to add to it some singlets. And the reason we add singlets is we want to start breaking this large gauge group. So NC, we have to take large to be in the Veneziano limit. So we're thinking of values of sort of 15 or something, SU15. We have to choose scalars in order to start breaking this down. And so the way that we can do it, we first add this scalar. And this is actually the paper we did last year. It has, it's charged under SUNC, and it's also charged under, so now we have to start gauging flavors as well. So we gauge SU2s out of the flavor in order to be the electroweak SU2. And so we're going to gauge SU2 left and also SU2 right. And then we charge this scalar under the SU2 right. All right, so it's an embedding of something that looks a bit like Patti Salam. That's where we start. I started calling it XPS, but then I realized that Dell's laptops are also called XPS, and they don't last more than 2 years. So that's not a very good start for this thing. Anyway, so it's an extension of Patti Salam, and you can break it to SU3 with this scalar. So this is the scalar. And I've just sort of delineated it. It's a bit like a squawk. So I've given you its delineation in terms of squawk. So the scalar, if you look at the charges of everybody, these things will be down and up squawks in doublets. So this is right-handed doublets along this one, corresponding to that thing. And these things are the electric charges, so the electromagnetic charges, plus or minus a half here, and then this is sleptons and stowns, if you were thinking of it as a squawk. And down here, you've got something that's uncharged under everybody. So this table of phi zeros, as I called it, so it's just a scalar here. So this one, we can just give it to Vev on the diagonal, and it breaks things down. So we have to start, it determines what we're going to be left with. It determines what the number of scalars is that we have to choose in order to get the right breaking. So you see, if I choose number of scalars is NC minus 2, I can rotate things so this is diagonal, and these zeros are left because I can also make SU2 right rotation, so it's engaged. That leaves me with, if you just look at this bit here, it looks like a Patti Salam theory. So you see, I'm breaking something down to SU3 cross U1 cross other stuff. And so you can see it. So I want you to just pay attention. Look, I'm told now what the number of scalars is I have to choose precisely to get the right thing. So it's kind of this sort of thing. I'm beginning with something, a whole load of crap, and it's flowing down, and I have to choose everything. just so that what I'm left with is the standard model and not something else. And so it precisely tells me what I have to choose. So that's the first thing that I have to choose. And this is the rest of it. So now I can start to associate my matter fields. So I have three generations. So I can have quarks, first, second, third generation, and leptons. And you see that this is really four elements because these are colored. So this is the first four components look like that. And I have three generations. And then there's a whole load of other stuff. And then my Higgses have to go along with the first three generations in doublets. So I'm forced to have my Higgses are actually 18, well, whatever, 80, however many doublets, nine 2x2s of SU2 left cross SU2 right. You see, you kind of get that you're going to have three generations of electroweak Higgses here, and then a whole load of other stuff, which is also going to have to get VEVs. And I claim that any time you try and construct a standard model inside an asymptotically safe theory, you will be doing this kind of thing. There's going to be no avoiding it. You need to start giving VEVs to things and getting rid of states as you flow down to the infrared. And I think this is pretty much the only way that you'll be able to do it. Okay, and so this is what the flow looks like in that theory. And so you're going to have color, and you're also going to have flavor. And the flavor, you have to control that with a large NF asymptotically safe fixed point. So the color fixed point, so that involves color G and the Yukawa coupling Y. That fixed point is the one of Litton-Sonino. And this one is the Gracie large NF fixed point, I'm going to call it. And so you can show that you can get both of those fixed points, and they don't really interfere with each other. So the flow is kind of like that. This is the Litton-Sonino flow, which is the SUNC flow. And this is the electroweak flow, which is kind of orthogonal to it. And it doesn't really affect the flow, the red flow, this flow. So you can show that's the case. You have to do a little bit of, squinting at diagrams like that in order to show that that's true. Right. Okay, so I'm going to just wrap up with the last thing you have to do, which is, there are still some states you need to remove. So you see, these states we never got rid of, even if we give VEVs to that thing, and we give VEVs to this thing, these states, they don't disappear. Everyone else is gone, but you still have all of these doublets that you need to get rid of. And you could have probably told me that because of chiral symmetry, that I'm never going to get rid of. I'm never going to get rid of these things unless I add NC-4 things to mop them up with and make Dirac masses. That's just a chiral symmetry statement. So I've got these 4 degrees of freedom. These ones I have to get rid of. So you need to extend the model a little bit more. It looks a little bit like that. Looks like that. So you have to add sort of partners for the guys who you want to make heavy inside these multiplets. And so you need NC-4 of them. So here, these ones. These things have to match the things we want to get rid of there. And again, you see it's determined precisely how many of these things we want to add in order to get rid of the stuff we don't want in those things. Right. Okay, but I claim that once you've added that stuff, there's nothing left but the standard model plus three generations of Higgses, which you can then give VEVs to as you want. Right. Okay, so I'm going to leave it there. So generally, I want you to take away this picture, basically. What we're in the business of doing is taking the standard model and trying to embed it inside something which is larger, which will flow down to precisely the standard model. And it's actually it's not so hard to do. And you're sort of pointed towards a Patti Salam type structure when you're doing that, which is kind of interesting. One of the things that you should bear in mind is that when you're doing this, you can really, you're sort of allowed to add any relevant operator that you want, as long as it's As long as it doesn't interfere with the fixed point. So it won't interfere with the fixed point because it's a relevant operator. So it's really just a question of choosing a gauge invariant, a renormalization invariant parameter for this particular flow. And every relevant operator will have one of those, including the mass squared. So technically, it's natural, even though you may question why you choose a particular value of a mass squared. That you can't answer, because that's always the way with an asymptotically safe theory. Right, so there are two sort of aspects to what we did. One is the radiative symmetry breaking, which is a little bit like the MSSM radiative symmetry breaking. And then constructing something which looks a bit like the standard model. So it's a kind of Patti Salam-ish structure. So now when you're doing this, I mean, so this is another, my second question. Hopefully it won't be like a 20-second answer to this one, but it may be the one. When you're doing this sort of thing, this is starting to remind me very much of what happens when you're doing a duality cascade. So you're beginning with a large number of degrees of freedom in the ultraviolet, and you're trying to, well, you're getting rid of them. And you're left with something, with some physics in the infrared, which is very kind of small. Precise. You've lost a lot of degrees of freedom. You're left with something, which could be, I mean, chiral symmetry breaking if you're doing a duality cascade or something like that. And so it's starting to look as if you ought to think of how to embed this sort of thing in something like a gravity dual for this picture. That there ought to be some way to embed this thing in a gravitational dual. That's my question. And I challenge you to answer that in 20 seconds.
That's unfair. I guess you know more than I do.
Anyway, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we have time for questions, please.
Yeah. So you said you skipped over it, the Coleman-Weinberg symmetry breaking doesn't work. Is it possible to say briefly what goes wrong?
I can show you, actually, it's not... So, I mean, it's sort of the naivest version of that you might try, I have to say. So it's not like a general theorem. I can say it can never work. And actually, we're kind of thinking about how it might work. But this is what you'd normally... So this is the picture that you know very well of Coleman-Weinberg. And so the way you'd approach it in these models is you would take some direction. So say you take the Higgs direction, the trace direction for the Higgs. So you do that. And so that's your classical potential, which looks like that. All of these couplings are determined for you along the trajectory. And that's really that's how you know it's not going to work, because there's no freedom at all. So these alpha Hs, alpha Vs, they're determined. And so you really, it's really just a question of looking at the one-loop potential and seeing what you get. And so I've added a mass term here, but you can ignore the mass term if you want to do Coleman-Weinberg. And just look at what happens at one loop. And at one loop, these corrections, they're of order alpha. They're suppressed by the coupling. So you have, so you've got lambda. But these things are suppressed by alpha. So alpha is not the NC alpha. Alpha is g squared over. So alpha is really just g squared on 4 pi, and g is small. So these are really one loop suppressed. So it doesn't work for the same reason it didn't work in the original Coleman-Weinberg, basically. So before they went to their electromagnetism, QED with a scalar. The reason they had to do that is because if I just do it with a scalar and a lambda phi to the 4, it won't work. Because you have to go to a strongly coupled theory to make this term as large as that one. So it's really for the same reason. And there's no freedom there. If I delete the mass squared term, all of these things are determined along the flow, and you know.
But how nothing. General is this conclusion? For which kind of theories, for sure?
I think for sure it would always be the same with just these Gauge-Yukawa theories. That's always true. You need to. Yeah, I think.
They're renormalizable theories.
Yeah, I think what you would have to do is you'd have to get at least two couplings in there, like kind of like in Coleman-Weinberg, so
you can hope that. works?
So with two couplings, you may be able to arrange it so that the one loop correction from one coupling can balance a small lambda. Doesn't necessarily have to be Yukawa couplings, just could be some other gauge coupling, maybe. It's not.
So you're saying that if you have one Yukawa, one quartic, then it doesn't work?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. I should say that we weren't the first to show that. I mean, this was done sort of soon after they came out with these models, because it's sort of the first question that you want to ask is whether this thing is actually the ultraviolet fixed point, whether it's going to give you some radiative symptoms. Yeah. Yep. Either.
So on the mascot operator, they remain relevant because the fixed point is weakly coupled, but is the correction towards irrelevance or toward enhancing?
In a way, it doesn't really matter.
Well, the background of the question is that if you go to a setting with fewer degrees of freedom, you're becoming more non-perturbative, right? Of course, and then things are difficult to control, but if the correction is of the mascot is in the direction of irrelevance, then that regime would be pretty interesting because the non-perturbative regime could then drive you into a setting where the mascot is irrelevant. So that's why I'm asking whether...
I see, right. Okay, yeah. I think I'm fairly sure that it's towards the mass squares are going, yeah, so they're towards the irrelevant direction.
So this is becoming smaller than two?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, let me just. So then that would mean that if you go into a non-perturbative.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So
assuming the fixed point would somehow persist in a non-perturbative regime, it could be.
It could be, but it would have to become non-perturbative. So that could be interesting to do that actually. Of course, at the beginning, I was kind of worried by that, but it doesn't really your instinct is to think, okay, well, it's not good to have it growing in the ultraviolet, but it's not growing very much in the ultraviolet. So it could be interesting. Yes.
So what is the minimal asymptotically safe standard model?
So minimal is a loaded word.
What is the minimal asymptotically safe standard model?
What is the minimal?
Minimal. I mean, I think this, I'm going to claim that this is it, pretty much.
I just got a generic description, so like how many fields do I have to add?
Let me show you. So I'm going to...
So you're adding a lot of stuff, and now you're saying,
I mean,
what is the minimal?
Right. Yeah. So I'd say it's this table, pretty much. So I can kind of talk you through the table a little bit. So the first three rows are the gauge Yukawa theory. So that's going to give you a fixed point for the strongly coupled part of the theory.
You have NC and F, it is a number of colors and fermions and such, but I mean, these are just, how many of those, I mean, you just...
So you can choose as many as you like, but you have to satisfy that you're in the Veneziano limit. Uh-huh. So they have their ratios are fixed. So for those ones you have, I don't know if I wrote it here somewhere. In this particular case, you need to have this. So NF over NC is 21 over 4 plus a small bit. So the epsilon is will be your effective one loop beta function. So it's going to be small in the Veneziano limit. So you choose NF and NC correctly to get that. And you see all of the other numbers are kind of determined for you as well. So NF is determined in terms of NC because of the Veneziano limit. Your NQ, so the number of these guys that you have to add, is also determined because you want to end up with precisely the standard model and not something else. So you have to add enough to leave yourself with your three colors plus the lepton, which is the Patti Salam sort of structure. And also these guys, I mean, they're all, so NS is also determined for you.
It's not something I can do in my head, but it's a minimal number of particles I have to add to the standard model.
The minimal number, everything is multiplied by NC. So NC times by all of this crap. So this is 21 over 4 NC, so that would be like 5 NC. Okay. So, you know, if this is, if you take NC as 10, this is something like 50 of those things. And then you've got, so 50 of that, so that's also 50. And then you, so this is going to be something like, so this isn't too bad. You've got NC minus 4 of those, so that's only 6.
And in terms of free parameters, what additional free parameters do I have?
The free parameters, so those ones, you're going to have all of the, so all of the mass squares that you want to add for everybody. Those things will generate a whole load of different VEVs for you. So
are they fixed by this? I mean, as I said, by the symbolic safety condition.
Those parameters. Yeah. So this is the nice thing about it is once you have this sort of structure, any relevant parameter, choose it as you like. Yeah. Mm. So if you want a hierarchy in the Higgs VEVs, you can go ahead and you can put it into the relevant parameters. So you do have some freedom there, but I mean, it's the usual asymptotically safe idea that part of the theory is super constrained because you need to get the ultraviolet fixed point. Everything else, all the relevant stuff, is completely free. So it's So all of your prediction is the critical surface, which is the
prediction is in the UV nine.
Yeah, the prediction is to do with the U. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's also the question of, I mean, here's a proof of concept. Whether you can do it or not, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, within perturbation theory, you can actually be sure that there will be a fixed point. So this, but also as Astrid said, we don't really know when we go beyond perturbation theory how many more ultraviolet conformal field theories you can find.
Yeah.
So this is really not the truth. Is there many? I mean, an example I can give is when we do the conformal window of QCD, but in the Benzach's epsilon regime, we find the fixed point. But then when we do it on the lattice. Epsilon can be 5, 6, 7, you still get fixed ones. Mm. So the conformal window is actually pretty immensely wide.
Where basically, once you got hit, you had to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somebody outside.
I know they would say something obvious.
Probably complain.
No, they must be really smart. Actually, the truth is that I'm pretty much convinced, and this is it's not a proof, but it's just from experience from the conformal window with QCD, that there is an immense amount of UV complete quantum field theories, because we know that epsilon can be actually pretty large. So this is, you know, in that sense, when you say it's minimal, actually, if epsilon is large, then FNC can be dramatically smaller than this. Mm. So this is just a proof of fact.
But I mean, it seems that this is a question that is easy to answer, but you still don't want to put a precise number. But if I want to minimize the number of parameters in my model, basically, what would it be? I mean, you said there are some conditions, but then you can actually do the exercise. So this is the minimal number of additional parameters I need to add to standard model to make it as a nice statement.
That's true, actually. Yeah, I mean, so that would be an interesting thing to figure out. Yep.
So given that I'm adding all of these degrees of freedom, can I use them to solve some of the problems of the standard model? So is there a natural dark matter candidate, and do you get a first order electron phase transition?
Sure. The answer is yes.
Okay.
I mean, there are tons of particles.
Yeah, I mean.
one that is stable at decoupling.
A vector like fermion, which is neutral, is better than some model.
But you're adding it on top.
Those are there. You can have them.
Hmm. Yeah, so this, these guys, together with the little q's, they make a vector like pairs of fermions. So you have those. I mean, but there's so much stuff that you have to add. I'd say, I mean, number one issue will be to prevent flavor changing from this thing. So what you'd like to do is have one of these to have a dominant VEV and the others to have a small or zero VEV, which is, and those guys are heavy. That's what you'd like to arrange. Yeah.
I mean, again, if we go away from the standard model for a second and just consider, for example, inflation, right, paper on inflation, right? So where you basically can, it's typically the potential that people use for inflation is 5 to the 4th, 5 squared, 5 to the 3rd. Now, we know that this can be the actual quantum field theory to use, because quantum field theory needs to be quantum corrected. you know, when a cosmologist do something which is kind of brutal, to be kind of modest, they just have a fight to some end. I imagine I start with a theory, which is, for example, the leading, you know, theory, and I just calculate the quantum potential, which I already did, and then I couple the minimum of gravity, which I did, and I study inflation depth, which we did. Now, what do you gain there? Remember that inflation, it was said that the you know, one of the problems of inflation, that the self-coupling should be very small. But in this series, it is naturally very, very small. I can make it as small as I want. And it's a geometric coupling. One of the problems of inflation is that, you know, indeed, why do you explain the 10 to the minus 4 in the amplitude of density perturbations? Because, you know, it's not natural to have a very small coupling. But now this coupling is geometric. At a fixed point in ultraviolet, I can make it as small as I want.
So you're saying you can choose the non-minimal coupling to the curvature to be...
Yeah, and it's natural, because this is just choosing number of flavors of color. It's not a continuous parameter. I mean, it's not the parameter that you are free to choose. And this is actually, I mean, one of these papers, more or less after the paper we've done it. I never really advertised it very much, but I mean, it's done. So even if you don't want to use for this other model, it's a proof of concept that it's not true that the cosmological constant, sorry, that the potential for inflation is fine-tuned. Because the coupling of the potential for inflation is a geometric coupling. I can make it as small as I want and keep it small, and then be completely quantum corrected.
So in what sense is it geometric?
Because the inflaton has a shift symmetry, or what is that?
Because it has an ultraviolet fixed point.
Which is small.
Exactly. I can make it small because it's proportional to epsilon. And epsilon is a geometrical number. It's only dependent number of frames of colors of the theory.
So the symmetry will be shift symmetry of the
inflaton? It's basically the
shift symmetry.
Yes, it's automatically shift. It's part of the theory is technically conformed. So it also has a shift symmetry.
Okay, let's see. I don't want to interrupt this interesting discussion, but I was just thinking whether we have perhaps a few more questions for our speaker, because otherwise we could continue the discussion over coffee now.
So I was just going to say one thing.
You should get down there.
Oh, really? Okay.
It was
to do with this question of the number of free parameters in the theory, because I'm kind of, this is why I was interested in the gravity dual of the thing, because if you are thinking in that way, no one would tell you that taking a large number of Kaluza-Klein modes in a gravity dual is if there are more Kaluza-Klein modes, it's somehow more fine-tuned, or there are more elements in the theory. It's just, I think, so the free the elements that you have to put into the parameters are kind of the what you're left with at the bottom, really, of the whole thing. So it's really...
No, Van, you're not talking about experimentalists, you're talking about theorists.
I'm talking about theorists, yeah. As a theorist, the number of free parameters in this theory is what I'm left with. Everything else is determined, you know, so the number of states I have to add in to get there is all determined.
But if you talk to an experimentalist and say, I have a very nice theory, but it has 100 extra parameters, then I don't think it's going to be as nice to them.
Okay, yeah, but actually, so with my supersymmetry string phenomenology hat on, I'm not seeing that this is much worse than what happens over there. 128 parameters over there. So.
I was hoping it was better.
Maybe with gravity it becomes much better.
Well, I hope so. Guess we'll see.
Okay, so I don't see any more urgent questions, so let's thank the speaker again.